I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now, a critical turn on the road to democracy in Iraq. Compromise has been reached on elections there, forged between the United States, the United Nations, and Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who's widely considered the single most powerful Iraqi in the country right now. According to the agreement announced yesterday, the United States will still hand over power to a new Iraqi government on June 30th. But Ayatollah Sistani will abandon his demand for a quick, direct, popular vote to choose a new government. In turn, the U.S. will give up its plan for a carefully stage-managed caucus-style election. So who will the U.S. hand over power to? How will a new interim Iraqi government be chosen? Joining us on the line from United Nations headquarters in New York City is Ahmed Fauzi, spokesman for the U.N. Special Envoy to Iraq, who brokered the compromise, Lakhdar Brahimi. Welcome, Mr. Fauzi.
Thank you very much.
Some kind of caretaker government's interim government will have to be set up as power is handed over to Iraqis June 30th.
Yes.
Which form do you think that will take?
Well, you see, when we were in Iraq, we met with many Iraqis. I would venture to say hundreds, from various walks of life, a real cross-section of Iraqi political, religious, social society. There were different views. Some thought the governing council was fine. Others thought it was not representative enough. Let's enlarge it. Others still thought, no, let's create a new body altogether. So that needs to be discussed at length with all the stakeholders in Iraq. They need to get together, bang their heads together, resolve their differences, and achieve political consensus that will lead to the formation of an acceptable, credible body that will receive sovereignty and power from the CPA, the coalition, at the end of June, and prepare the country for elections.
How concerned are you, though, that this process drags on too long and Iraqis become restless? They want some sense that they are having a larger hand in their own destiny and that it's not all being controlled by a governing council made up in large part of Iraqis who weren't even in Iraq for many years, of exiles and of elites.
Yeah, extremely concerned. We are concerned. Mr. Brahimi is concerned. The Secretary General is concerned. The Iraqis themselves are concerned that the current situation, with which is reinforcing divisions between the ethnic groups and all the parties, is raising tensions, increasing distrust, and it's a dangerous situation for Iraq.
You work for the United Nations. You're in the business of compromise. It's been said that compromise is when nobody's completely happy. You traveled to Iraq with Lakhdar Brahimi. You attended meetings with Ayatollah Ali Sistani and with Provisional Authority Head Paul Bremer. What was the atmosphere in that room?
Extremely positive. It was quite amazing, whether it was with Bremer or Sistani. There was a determination in all the meetings to try and resolve this problem. Sistani was extremely grateful that the Secretary General had sent a man of Brahimi's stature. He was extremely interested in listening to Mr. Brahimi. The Ayatollah Sistani, despite his age, is extremely articulate, well-read, and well-informed. And they spoke for 2.5 hours, and it was a very lively debate in which Mr. Brahimi explained the complexities of holding elections in the current atmosphere in Iraq to the Ayatollah Sistani. The Ayatollah had arguments of his own, which Mr. Brahimi listened to with great interest. At the end of the meeting, after 2.5 hours, I think there was an understanding on both sides. On the Ayatollah's side, there was an understanding that it would be difficult to hold elections between now and June 30th. There was an understanding that elections are the best way to achieve the democratic aspirations of a people, but you had to prepare well for elections. As Mr. Brahimi said, we need to hold elections as early as possible, but not earlier than possible.
Mr. Fauzi, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Delaney.
Ahmed Fauzi is spokesman for UN Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi. Well, we're joined now by Elizabeth Palmer, a CBS News correspondent in Baghdad. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Pleasure.
Elizabeth, how aware are Iraqis that even the U.S. caucus-style plan for elections is now off the table, and direct elections aren't likely any time before next year.
I think that the ordinary Iraqis didn't ever understand the formula for the American caucus-style election.
Yeah.
And they're focusing on something quite different. They do understand that the handover of power, however symbolic it is, at the end of June, is still on. And they also know that there's huge pressure and American promises for elections. So the formula is less important to them than the milestone dates and the fact that there will be an election.
Elizabeth, we just heard from Ahmed Fauzi of the UN that Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who has the allegiance, as you know, of 60% of Iraqi's population, the Shia, has shown patience and moderation in meetings with him. Is that what he's communicating, patience and moderation to the Shia in Iraq?
Yes, I think it's a case of the iron fist in the velvet glove, though. Ayatollah Sistani is proving to be a very shrewd politician. He has managed to make the American authorities move up the date for the handover of power and the election, it looks like, and he has never wavered. Now, that being said, he's also managed to snuff out what could be massive civil unrest. And in that sense, he's behaving very responsibly. He is discouraging people who don't agree with the pace of the process from making trouble now.
He's almost certainly the most powerful Iraqi in Iraq. How is he seen at the moment by Kurds and Sunnis?
And Christians, I would add.
And Christians.
Probably pretty frightening, because he seems to be wanting to take a lot of political power for the Islamic clerics and unite the mosque and the state, something that the other groups, the minority groups, and the American authorities are very much against. So although they think that he's responsible, they also think that he has a hidden agenda, and that is to make Islamic law the law of the new Iraq, something that a lot of people feel a lot of trepidation about.
Well, when you say trepidation, just to finish up, Elizabeth, is it the kind of trepidation that could turn into something violent in this country that is divided three ways, at least ethnically?
Well, it's a very fragile time, and a lot of people feel almost anything could spark a civil war, from a violent act to a public political insult from one ethnic group to another. But I think the real power struggle is going to come over this issue, and it may be between the American authorities and Sistani. How much of an Islamic State is this going to be? Over the next few weeks and months, that is going to be sharp and probably quite contentious.
Elizabeth Palmer of CBS News joined us from Baghdad. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
It's been 1 year since the fire at the Station nightclub in West Warwick, Rhode Island, turned a night out on the town into a nightmare. The fire, which started when a pyrotechnics display by the heavy metal band Great White burned out of control, quickly turned the club into a death trap. 100 people were killed by the fire and about 200 others were injured. Everyone in the small state of Rhode Island seemed to know someone who was at the Station nightclub that night. Teresa O'Toole was at the station. She's a board member of the Station Family Fund. She lives in Framingham, Massachusetts, and she joins us on the line now. Welcome, Teresa.
Thank you for having me.
Teresa, what are your thoughts today on this anniversary?
It's kind of hard for me to say. I haven't really thought much about, you know, the fact that it's the anniversary. I'm more focused on raising funds, and we have a lot of benefits coming up over the next few days. But it doesn't give me much time to really think about what happened that night.
What did you see that night?
You know, I saw a lot of, you know, you can't really begin to explain what you really saw, but I was close to the door with my husband. I knew right away that the walls had caught on fire. And, you know, I turned to him and I said, you know, we have to get out of here. That's fire. He was so, in, you know, he was busy watching the band that he didn't even realize what was going on. And we actually got out the door. We were probably one of the last few people to walk out that main front door. And I didn't really expect it to be as bad as it was until I got outside and, you know, I looked back and saw how quickly the building had caught on fire. I mean, I knew right then that it was going to be a bad night.
Is it something you and your husband have talked a lot about or not? Do you keep it sort of inside?
I don't really talk about it a lot. He's actually the vice president of the fund, so he does a lot of communicating with the media and talking to a lot of people to get us help. So he talks about it a lot, and I think for me, some part of it, just hearing him talk about it over and over again, there's a part of me that doesn't want to hear it anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
I kind of want to deal with it myself.
You know, we read about things like the Station nightclub fire, and we think it's almost abstract. It happens to someone else.
Right.
What do you feel about that? You went there that night for just some goofy fun.
That's basically, I think, how everybody feels. You never expect anything like that to happen to you. And, you know, until something like that happens, you don't think it's real.
How does it change you when it does happen to you?
The one thing that I've definitely noticed is I have a hard time being in crowds or in an area where I feel like I can't get out. I always make sure I can look around and get out right away. If I feel like I'm going to get trapped at all, I won't go in or won't go there. Or, you know, It's one thing I do feel.
The club's owners, Jeffrey and Michael Derderian, as well as Great White's manager, Daniel Bichelle, have been indicted. How important is that to you?
I think it's a start. I definitely was surprised that they didn't go after, you know, more people. Surprised that, you know, the fire inspector wasn't named in any of this at all. You know, because I think, to me, that's why you have a fire inspector. You know, everybody can claim, I didn't know. But you have people in, you know, those roles to prevent that from happening. And he, you know, to me, clearly didn't do his job.
Teresa, there's a memorial service tonight. Are you going to go?
No, I won't be going to the site. I didn't lose anybody that night, and I think the people who did, if that's where they want to be, that's where they want to be. I'm actually going to be at a benefit show that's going to hopefully help raise us money for the fund.
Tell us about the Station Family Fund.
It was basically started by a group of survivors and some family members and a few people in the community that were affected, you know, just the whole fire affected them. And we're an all nonprofit organization. We're all volunteer. And we basically got together when we heard about one of the survivors losing their apartment because they couldn't make rent and, you know, being thrown out on the street. And we're like, this can't happen. There's about 20 families that rely on us every month. We pay everything from mortgages to rent to, you know, car payments, car insurance, phone bills and things like that.
Teresa O'Toole is a board member of the Station Family Fund. She lives in Framingham, Massachusetts. Teresa, thanks a lot.
Well, thanks for having me.
Just ahead, an exhibit of African-American dolls highlights the changing image of black Americans. And later in the show, Oscar second guesses. What did the Academy get right and what did they get wrong in awarding the prestigious statue? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now.
Hey, look at the farmer one over there.
I like them.
Rag dolls, porcelain dolls, and one-of-a-kind creations are gathered in a new exhibit called If These Dolls Could Talk, 150 Years of Black Dolls at the Museum of Afro-American History in Boston.
I also like how they're, you know, different shapes and sizes, just like us from around the world.
The dolls represent something much more than just playthings or display items. They are important cultural and historical artifacts, and to many African-American women, they're reminders of a childhood when there were very few options for kids who wanted dolls that looked like them. Earlier this week, my co-host, Robin Young, visited the museum where she spoke with executive director Beverly Morgan Welch.
When you see 15 or more of these delicate, beautiful dolls made over the course of 150 years, they were kind of begging to be shown off and for people to think about their creation and what it says about African American history and culture.
I want to look closely at these very old dolls. Now, the one on the left is, you know, a little girl with a headscarf on, black hair, black skin. What is that face made of?
It's all cotton fabric.
Well, now we move down and some of the dolls get more sophisticated. Those aren't
No. Yeah, they're corn husk dolls. Yeah. And you can see from the sleeves, there are these dolls that are made from wooden spoons. I mean, this is a way of showing kind of the craftspersonship of the time and what people were making these dolls from. I mean, you make them from what you're using in your life.
These dolls in this case over here look more contemporary.
Mm-hmm. They are. In fact, if you remember, the Clarks did a study in the 40s where they presented black children with black dolls and white dolls, and they preferred the white dolls because they said they were prettier. And so in the 60s in particular, dolls begin to be beautiful clothing, color, and not these depictions of the much-beloved Mammy doll and Aunt Jemima dolls.
When you were growing up, did you have black dolls? Are you giving me, you're giving me a face.
I did not play with dolls. I had an experience early on where a little girl friend who was white said that it was too bad that I couldn't have dolls that were pretty like her. And, you know, I thought, what in the world? I must have been five. And I was very confused by that statement. What does that mean? I'm not pretty. I had a huge doll house. No dolls. Now, I'll buy almost any black doll I see lonely somewhere in some store. I'm a fool for those, as are so many other people who see them perhaps languishing alone. What people should know, for those persons who are collectors, that are, of course, the black dolls are rare, and they're worth more.
Karen Spiller, who's a collector and also an artist, I've been seeing you nod in agreement with a lot of the things you're hearing Beverly say.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting, though. I did have early experience with dolls, and my first doll was Thumbelina, and a miniature Thumbelina where you could hold her in your hands.
For those who didn't have one, she was a little ballerina.
Yes.
Was she a black Thumbelina?
She was not. At that time, it was very difficult to, again, Beverly said that, in terms of black dolls, so she was white. My next special doll was Barbie. I got in 1961. It was the first bubble-cut Barbie with the brunette hair. And it was, I think, when my mom bought her, she thought of her as being closest to looking like me. The skin was toasty brown, and the hair was a vibrant red, and it was just the closest to the complexion. So those are my first experiences with dolls.
What does that mean to you to have a collection?
Well, dolls are almost like people to me. They all have their own personality. They all have their different birthplace in terms of maybe who was the giver of the gift or what country the dolls come from.
What are some of the countries?
I've had dolls from, of course, Africa, from Bosnia, England.
So these are dolls of many colors?
Many colors. I feel it's a very diverse, eclectic kind of group. They come in terms of cloth, they're porcelain, they're clay. If you enter my home, you will find them sitting on chairs and sofas, coat rack. They're just everywhere. It just gives me a sense of comfort.
There are a lot of doll collectors, black and white and all shades of color. But is there anything, do you think, that you know, has to do with your being African-American that has to do with your doll collecting?
Absolutely. I do look for dolls that look like me in complexion. Interestingly enough, I had a friend who lived in northern Michigan, and she was white, and she made dolls. And the interesting thing is she was making Raggedy Ann and Andy's, and she always had that pinkish color fabric. And I said, well, can you make her brown? So we spent 3 days going shopping to find the right color brown. So we ended up getting a fabric, it's a wool blend. And then she made Raggedy Ann and Andy's for me.
Beverly, I'm looking down here and I see, and then finally a crescendo as Barbie. There's a black Barbie with quite an outfit on down there. When did the black Barbie?
Yeah, I believe, I mean, Barbie gets a friend who is African-American first, and then Barbie becomes herself black. I think around 1980, there's a, 81 maybe, there's a black Barbie doll. You can see the love, warmth, and attention paid to these dolls. It's a very important aspect of how we see ourselves and how we learn to play. So I think that it is important to understand that while now maybe I can afford more dolls than I would have bought as a child, it means so much more to me in many ways about culture, about self-identity, and about my own daughter having dolls that look like her.
Beverly Morgan Welch is executive director of the Museum of Afro-American History. Robin also spoke with Karen Spiller, a doll collector. For more information on the exhibit, If These Dolls Could Talk, 150 Years of Black Dolls, check out our website at here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Two men named John, both senators, both vying for the Democratic nomination for the presidency, and both, as Super Tuesday approaches March 2nd, now trying to emphasize just how different they are from each other. But how distinct are John Kerry of Massachusetts and John Edwards of North Carolina? Edwards, of course, finished a strong second place in Wisconsin earlier this week. He seized on trade as the major issue differentiating him from Kerry, and it seemed to work for him. But Kerry told reporters on Wednesday that we, meaning he and Edwards, have the same policy on trade. The AFL-CIO, the country's largest labor union, has now thrown its backing behind Kerry. Well, to trade in some analysis and forecasting on these and other political issues, we're joined by Andrea Stone, congressional reporter for USA Today. Hi, Andrea. And Peter Canellos is Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. Peter, John Edwards says he'd consider dismantling major trade pacts like NAFTA. He wants greater protection for American workers whose jobs are being outsourced abroad. How realistic is all that? For one thing, can you really rejigger a trade pact that's already signed, sealed, and long delivered?
I mean, you can if you want to reopen it and reopen negotiations. Certainly it would be within the president's ability to try to push that through. It may take a little while. And I think there is broad agreement among all the Democratic contenders that it would be a good idea to start pressuring some of the trade partners to add more wage standards and more environmental standards into their own industrial policies so that there'd be more of an even playing field. But I think that's a long way from believing that if John Edwards were elected president, he would immediately put a stop to global free trade. I think most economists believe that would be a disaster for the United States.
This week, Kerry said, look, there's no difference on trade between Edwards and me.
Right. I mean, he also noted that they both voted for a trade pact with China. You know, Kerry is saying that Edwards is a Johnny-come-lately to this whole issue, that, you know, as recently as June, he made a major speech on the economy, didn't even mention trade, so that he's being a little opportunistic here. And I think yesterday, you know, the AFL-CIO coming out, you know, they are definitely not advocates. They're opponents of NAFTA, and yet they came out for John Kerry because they obviously see him as the best chance to beat George Bush in November.
Well, speaking of chances, Peter, Edwards does seem to be enjoying a surge after Wisconsin. The bottom line remains, though, doesn't it, that he still won only one primary in his birth state of South Carolina. What would Edwards have to do, Peter, to become a real threat to Kerry? Can he get the nomination at this point?
I think he could get it, but only if Kerry were to slip up very, very badly, if there were some unforeseen event or unforeseen revelation that sort of raised real and sort of sudden doubts about Kerry, you know, then I think obviously the math is there for John Edwards to emerge as the front runner.
But wouldn't he have to really run the table in primaries from now on out?
He'd have to come close to doing that, and it's highly unlikely. I mean, even what the media might perceive as a good showing on Super Tuesday would still leave him way behind in delegates.
Right. And he's not campaigning everywhere. You know, there are 10 states on Super Tuesday. In fact, there's also three next week that both of them are ignoring. Basically, Edwards is going to be concentrating in Georgia, where I think he has the best chance of winning, if anywhere. Ohio, a really pivotal state, and upstate New York. I don't think California, will bother to go out there except for maybe a debate and some fundraising. So it's really hard to see where John Edwards has some wins, and he's got to have some wins. You know, second place or close is not going to work.
On the other hand, Andrea, it's probably good for John Kerry to have Edwards in the race, right? It keeps him sharp, and it keeps Democrats on the front pages of the newspapers.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the reasons that John Edwards did so well in Wisconsin was that John Kerry kind of let his guard down a little bit. He started getting sloppy right after his wins in Tennessee and Virginia, you know, in Edwards' backyard in the South. He took a couple days off.
Can't do that.
I don't think you'll see him doing that again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think he was feeling very comfortable.
Peter, lest we forget, a certain Howard Dean dropped out of the race this week. Where does his support go?
Most of it will go to Kerry. I think that the Dean supporters' bottom line for them was opposition to the war in Iraq, and John Edwards has not nearly expressed the opposition to the war in Iraq that Kerry has. Edwards, particularly in South Carolina, took a much more hawkish line. I think if any Howard Dean supporter were to really look at the records, and these are hardcore supporters, so they certainly will, they'll go for John Kerry.
Andrea, does Howard Dean sort of drop out of the picture now or remain a very important player right through the convention in Boston this summer?
Well, he's saying he's not dropping out. He's converting his campaign into a movement, which is what it sort of
right,
was.
But will people like John Kerry be listening to what he has to say?
I think both John Kerry and John Edwards would love to have an endorsement from Howard Dean. I think you'll see him at the convention having a very prominent role, but also the party has to move on now. I happen to think that some of those Dean supporters might go to Edwards. While Dean didn't endorse anybody when he dropped out, some of his language seemed to be talking about outsiders, and you know, he still is a very anti-Washington establishment guy. And while both of them are senators, John Kerry's been there 19 years.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one amendment to that is there is a certain amount of animosity between the Kerry and Dean forces. And if you are a truly partisan Deaniac, you might have built up a lot of resistance to John Kerry. I do think that as the campaign goes on and as the Dean supporters look at the positions of the two candidates, they'll find that Kerry's closer to Dean.
Polls taken earlier this week show if the election were today, either Edwards or Kerry would probably beat President Bush by double digits. What do you make of that, if anything?
Well, I mean, I think that all along, the president's forces have been saying this will be a close election, and a lot of the Democrats have been predicting a close election. So I think it'll be a close election, and I think there'll be a lot of seesawing between now and then. I mean, a month ago, if you asked all the smart prognosticators in Washington, they would say, oh, Bush, it's looking good. He'll win 40 states. Now all the smart prognosticators are saying Bush could easily lose. Democrats are looking really good. You know, a month or two from now, Bush will have regained his legs and he'll be back up in the polls. Then the Democratic convention will come along and the Democrats will be up again. I think we're in for that kind of a ride.
Should we even bring up double-digit polls in February before a November election, Andrea?
It might be a little early, but one indication that we're starting to see is that some Republicans are getting nervous. There was a story today that some evangelical Christians are very upset with the president that he hasn't come out strongly enough about the whole gay marriage situation in San Francisco.
Right. They're saying they're going to sit it out.
Right. I mean, and, you know, if they sit it out, that's going to be a real problem for the president. If he can't get his base out, let alone independents and swing voters, he could be in trouble. So I definitely think there is some concern. I mean, look, the Republicans thought they were going to be going up against Howard Dean. And when that didn't pan out, I think they really had to, fix up the playbook. And now they're scrambling. And I think some of the party faithful, you know, talking to some of the state parties, are starting to get a little concerned.
Andrea Stone is a congressional reporter for USA Today. Thanks a lot, Andrea.
My pleasure.
Peter Canellos is the bureau chief of the Boston Globe in Washington. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG. Or call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. And still to come, Oscar second guesses. Our film reviewers tell us what they think should get the big prize. You're listening to Here and Now. A federal appeals court in Dallas has agreed to hear a request from Norma McCorvey. If that name doesn't ring a bell, she's also known as Jane Roe, the plaintiff in the historic 1973 Roe v. Wade case, which established a constitutional right to abortion. McCorvey, who's now an anti-abortion activist, wants the decision overturned. Joining us on the line is Trevor Morrison. He's assistant professor of constitutional law at Cornell Law School in Ithaca, New York. Mr. Morrison, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. How could this be up for appeal, Trevor? Wasn't this a Supreme Court decision?
Yes, it was. There's basically very little hope that this challenge is going to succeed. First of all, a lower federal court cannot undo a Supreme Court precedent, so there's no hope of undoing the reasoning in any authoritative way, not only of Roe versus Wade, but of subsequent precedents, most notably the Casey decision from the Supreme Court in the early 90s, and as recently as a few terms ago, the Stenberg versus Carhart decision, where the court struck down a partial birth abortion ban from Nebraska, both reaffirmed the core reasoning of the Roe decision. So in that sense, Ms. McCorvey has a very steep uphill climb.
Yeah, and a federal district judge threw out her initial request for this in June, saying it was not made within a reasonable amount of time. So why is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit agreeing to hear McCorvey's arguments March 2nd?
Well, a court may sometimes, in fact, often is inclined to allow an appellant her day in court to make arguments, but I think it would be a mistake to read too much into that decision on its own. This may be simply a matter of allowing Ms. McCorvey to air an argument, but I would be very surprised if she has any prospect of success there. The basic reason that the district judge relied upon is the most likely one that the Federal Court of Appeals will rely on, which is that it's simply too late. Even assuming that there might have been a time when she could have undone this decision, it's simply too late to do it now. In fact, what she has said, at least in the press, what the press is reporting her is saying, is that challenging this decision is something she's wanted to do since day one, in her words. If that's so, then that means she had an opportunity to try and bring this challenge many years ago, and her failure to do that amounts to a waiver of any chance she might have had.
Right. She says very early on she concluded that abortion damages women psychologically. But federal courts have been getting more conservative over the last several years. Is there any way that she could take this beyond what you seem to think and others seem to think will largely be presenting her point of view March 2nd, and it ends there?
I would be shocked to see it. I think, first of all, even the substance of her argument might be one that is attractive to policymakers. That is, what she says is the psychological harm that comes to women from abortion. But we don't normally think that the presence or absence of a constitutional right turns on whether it's helpful or harmful to a person's psyche. I think in this circumstance, there's very little likelihood that she will have any success at all. And I think it's extremely likely that if the Court of Appeals did entertain and hold favorably on her challenge, that the Supreme Court would correct that error very quickly.
Trevor Morrison, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Trevor Morrison is an assistant professor of constitutional law at Cornell Law School in Ithaca, New York. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Probably as long as there have been Academy Awards, there's been Academy Award second-guessing. Why didn't Citizen Kane, for example, widely considered by many film critics to be the greatest movie of all time, not win Best Picture in 1941? What did? that other immortal classic, How Green Was My Valley? Well, Here and Now film reviewers Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham join us in the studio with their own Oscar second guesses, and welcome to you both.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill. Hi, guys. Renee, just to start somewhere, Al Pacino, just to cite one example, won for Scent of a Woman, not for Godfather 2.
Not for Godfather 2, not for Godfather 1, not for Dog Day Afternoon, not for Serpico. He wins for this horribly overacted film.
Kind of,
and this
film.
Role where he plays a blind retired lieutenant colonel who hires an assistant to help him. And it's just this sort of big, blowsy, overdone performance.
I've been around, you know. There was a time I could see. And I have seen boys like these, younger than these, their arms torn out, their legs ripped off. But there is nothing like the sight of an amputated spirit. There is no prosthetic for that.
So, Eric, what's the deal? At a certain point, Oscar will decide it's his turn. He really deserves it. She really deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of instances where you have these sort of, you know, career achievement awards where somebody's lost many times and they finally, you know, give them one of those career achievement awards. You know, the year that that Pacino won for Scent of a Woman, he was actually up for a much better performance in the supporting actor category when he was up for Glengarry Glen Ross. Mm-hmm. Gene Hackman won that year. But the even bigger oversight was the fact that Alec Baldwin for Glengarry Glen Ross wasn't even nominated. You know, that galvanizing, venomous performance that really kicks that whole movie off, Baldwin wasn't even nominated.
Have I got your attention now? Good. Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
Sticking with our theme, Renee, Denzel Washington, great actor, wins for Training Day.
Right. He was also nominated that same year that Al Pacino won.
Right,
for Malcolm X. Far Which better was, performance. Just an ex- I think the best performance he's ever given.
An epic performance.
And then he wins, you know, years later for Training Day. Again, it was, you know, one of these, this big scenery-chewing performance as a corrupt cop. And, you know, it was, you could almost in every moment, you could see him thinking, I'm so going to win an Oscar for this, and I'm so going to win an Oscar.
I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. And you ain't going to do a damn thing, because you ain't going to shoot no cop in the back, are you?
Don't do it.
You know what they give you for that? The gas chamber. You know what the gas chamber smells like? Pine oil. That's where you headed, boy. To pine oil heaven. I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. I don't believe you got it in you, Jake. I'm going to go get it right now.
And, Eric, it's not just actors and actresses. It's movies themselves.
Though. Yeah, it certainly is movies themselves. Going back just a few years, Gladiator wins Best Picture. And, you know, it's a fun movie. It's a great sort of action drama film. But that was the same year. We also had Traffic, which was a very thoughtful, very interesting movie about drug trafficking. And even better, there was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was, you know, a magnificent film.
You know, I can almost agree with Eric. I wouldn't have had a problem with if Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon had won instead of Gladiator. But if Traffic had won, that movie was overrated, and it didn't even come anywhere near.
Well, here's the problem then, isn't it? It's awfully subjective, isn't it?
Oh, always. I mean, so are the nominations themselves that come from the Academy.
Right. It's awfully subjective, and it's also very political, too. You know, a lot of it has to do, I think, with, you know, who individual voting members may be working for at the time, who they'd like to see win, who, you know, is campaigning. And, you know, one of the nice things, I guess, about this season is that they've shortened the time frame from the nominations to the awards, so there's maybe not as much campaigning as usual.
Less time for stupidity on the part of the studios.
Now, Renee, looking ahead to February 29th, this year's Oscars, are you looking for surprises?
Well, there's an interesting one. I mean, Patricia Clarkson is nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Pieces of April.
We need to discuss how each of you... Oh, God.
It's okay, sweetie.
How each of you, in your own way... is going to handle discarding food without letting our hostess know.
Oh, please.
She's the best thing in the film, but I think she was actually better in Far From Heaven. But she wasn't nominated for that. That was just a few years ago. So there's a feeling of the Academy maybe looking and going, oh, wow, she was good in that film, but we'll look at her more for this one and we'll give her the nomination for this one. But it's hard to complain. She had a very good year. She had Pieces of April. She also had The Station Agent. So I think the nomination this year is actually for both.
Sometimes it just becomes a critical mass, doesn't it, Eric?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, you've got that this year in the documentary category with Errol Morris finally being nominated for The Fog of War. It's hard to believe this is his first ever nomination for a Best Oscar for documentary.
I want to say, and this is very important, at the end, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. We came that close to nuclear war at the end. Rational individuals. Kennedy was rational. Khrushchev was rational. Castro was rational. Rational individuals came that close to total destruction of their societies. And that danger exists today.
Chances are he'll probably lose out to Capturing the Freedmans, which was sort of a phenomenon. But certainly, if the Academy were to give it to him for The Fog of War, that would be sort of one of these career achievement awards.
Renee, any nominations you're personally particularly happy about?
I was happy to see Keisha Castle Hughes get a nomination for Whale Rider.
My name is Pakia Apirana, and I come from a long line of chiefs, stretching all the way back to Hawaiki, where our ancient ones are. The ones that first heard the land crying and sent a man. His name was also Pakia. And I'm the most recent descendant. But I was not the leader my grandfather was expecting, and by being born, I broke the line back to the ancient ones.
You know, a very small film. I thought a very charming film. I was surprised she got the nomination. She was 12 or 13 years old when she did the role. Children never get nominated in leading categories. They're usually nominated in best supporting categories. So I was happy to see her get it in what I think would have gone to Nicole Kidman. So I was really happy about that.
Nicole Kidman, Cold Mountain, Eric
Schaefer. Yeah, and I was happy to see Nicole not get nominated because it was a very lackluster performance. And I was frankly happy to see Cold Mountain get shut out in the best picture category as well. I think it says something for the people who actually nominate the films that maybe they are beginning to sort of look through the haze and the fog and the campaigning a bit now and really go a little bit more for films that are more deserving.
Renee, anything that bugs you about these nominations this year?
American Splendor being all but ignored.
All but ignored, yeah.
All but
wonderful
it
movie.
Got one nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay, which it certainly deserved. But, man, how did this film, you know, Paul Giamatti in the lead role, Hope Davis for actress, I thought it was the best movie of the year, and somehow the Academy just didn't get it.
You're a vegetarian?
Kinda, you know, I mean, ever since I got a pet cat, you know, I've had a lot of trouble eating animals.
Huh. I support and identify with groups like PETA, but unfortunately I'm a self-diagnosed anemic. Also, I have all these food allergies to vegetables, which give me serious intestinal distress. I guess I have a lot of borderline health disorders that limit me politically when it comes to eating.
Eric, what do you think's going to win?
Well, I think that, you know, probably The Lord of the Rings is going to take Best Picture. It's probably going to take Best Director as well. Maybe not because this particular film was, you know, any better than the other two films, but it's sort of like a collective award for this trilogy.
Over the 9 hours or whatever
it
is.
And just for the fact that, you know, Peter Jackson was able to juggle all those balls, keep them all in the air when he was making this film, a logistical nightmare, and the fact that, hey, they've made a lot of money, too.
He made people care about hobbits, and nobody thought anyone would care.
Here and Now film reviewers, Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham, thanks to you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.